How did you come upon this?
I teach a class on violence in early America. I assigned my students a sort of overview reading of violent episodes to get them thinking about what they might want to research. And the Harp murders were mentioned in a couple of sentences. They were described as maybe the frontier killers of Kentucky, 30 murders or so. I immediately thought, why don't I know this story? And how come nobody's written about it recently? I just was sort of immediately pulled down the rabbit hole. I was intrigued and hooked from that moment.
But you also describe this as a perennial theme in American life, that today, a lot is written about the nature of violence in this country. It seems like you're pointing way back that this is historic here.
This is a problem that has plagued us for a long time. America's a violent society. There are all kinds of theories about why that's the case, but it is the case. I think we also particularly have a problem with young, especially white, disaffected men who go on these violent rampages. The story I'm telling has some similarities to a modern mass shooter. And so one of the things that I'm trying to do is really explore this as a problem that dates to America's earliest days.
I think most people think about that dating from the Civil War because of the leftover feelings with the people who served in the Confederacy.
Mm-hmm.
But you're going back really to the founding of the Republic,
right?
With two guys who sided with the British, not the Americans.
Right, that is part of their story. They were loyalists, so they were on the losing side, essentially, of the Revolution. We just don't know enough about the aftermath of the American Revolution. It's not a war that we think of as having been particularly brutal, but there was much of it that was truly sort of horrific guerrilla civil warfare, especially in the South. These two brothers speak to that story. One of the other things the American Revolution does is it says to men in particular, we're going to give you the right to pursue happiness. You are entitled to life and liberty and the American dream. And that's kind of a new thing, frankly, for men of, you know, particularly sort of lower status to be able to think they're entitled to that. Very quickly, people start to run up against their inability to fulfill those dreams. And that is a kind of engine of real anger.
You're interested in the range of resources that are here at the Humanities Institute and at UConn. And I saw that you mentioned at least in a couple of places, specifically psychology, criminology, to try and, I guess, understand how this began and provide some historical perspective.
I'm trying to think outside the box a little bit. Of course, I'm looking at newspapers and court records and all of the traditional kinds of historical documents you might look for in this kind of project. But I have also really been trying to sort of think about, why do people commit murder? What makes men violent? What is the psychology of that? What's the sociology of that? Criminology and psychology have contributed, I think, to my thinking about these two murderers. They didn't leave behind diaries. They did not leave behind letters. I'm not even sure they're really literate. I've had to think about what is the human psychology of this kind of behavior. And they really are, I think, rampage killers. This is something we see in American history from time to time, but they're sort of an origin point, in a way, of thinking about why do people go on these sort of murderous rampages.
What is it that causes them to be described as so-called serial killers?
That category has only even existed since about the 1970s. So nobody's calling them that in the 1790s. But people do call them that today. And it's because they commit a series of murders over time, and that fits in some ways the modern FBI definition of what serial killing is. More than three or four victims separated by cooling off periods. To my mind, they don't really fit a lot of the other behavioral characteristics that serial killers often have. There's nothing kind of perversely sexual about any of the murders. They don't seem to be driven by the same type of motivations that are typical of modern serial killers. I think they are better understood as spree killers or rampage killers.
They don't end together, as you might think,
right,
given the way that they're described?
Well, you know, we're talking about a period when criminal justice and law enforcement are pretty rickety and primitive. When they're committing murders in Kentucky, it's really just the county sheriff, maybe a couple of constables. Sometimes local people will round up a posse of just ordinary men to try to pursue them. That didn't work very well. There is a moment when they're in western Kentucky and one of the survivors of their violence is able to round up a posse of men and track them down. And Micaiah, who is the sort of brawnier, bigger, muscular brother, was essentially lynched. He's really tracked down, shot, beheaded, and it's in an act of really retributive vengeance. Willie, though, escaped and disappeared. And so one of the great mysteries about this story is what happened to Willie. Willie vanishes from Appalachia, never seen again. But 2 or 3 years later, the federal government starts to suspect that this river pirate in the Mississippi borderlands may in fact be Willie Hart. And it starts to sort of gather momentum that this person who's involved in committing them might be Willie. And eventually, to make sort of a long, complicated story short, the Spanish and American governments collaborate to capture him and he's executed. We can't know for sure ever, I don't think, whether or not it's truly Willie Harp, but several people who knew him in Tennessee and then met him again in Mississippi said, oh yeah, that's Willie.
What is your goal for being here in stores?
I'm trying to write as much as I can. This is a book that I hope will be a kind of crossover book that really speaks to the general public, that general readers can read. People like my father can read, who are just sort of interested readers. I'm working on narrating the story as appealingly and as engagingly as I can. But I'm also sort of filling in blanks of research. One of the things that's been difficult about it is figuring out what's fact and what's folklore. Because, as you can imagine, these two were pretty famous and well-known in the immediate aftermath of these murders. I mean, in the 19th century, they became kind of folk, I don't want to say heroes, but folk celebrities, maybe. Herman Melville mentions them in one of his novels, calls them thugs. William Faulkner mentions the Harps in pieces of his writing. It's been hard in some way to sort of separate out who really were they in 1798 versus what has been said around firesides and hearths in the decades afterwards.
Historians rely on documents,
yeah,
and testimonials. So this is a really hard challenge because there was really not much officially documented on these guys.
Yeah, it's true.
Why did you pick such a tough subject?
Oh, gee, that's a question I've asked myself many times since beginning this project. I'm realizing and have been realizing for a long time now, this is a high bar of difficulty because there isn't the sort of rich trove of materials that you would hope to have. Gosh, it's just such an incredible story. I couldn't resist it as a narrator. But also, I think it really does speak to a lot of the problems we're still grappling with in this country, trying to understand what sort of are the wages of freedom. Does being free and having liberty mean we also have to accept this kind of level of violence that we've always lived with to some extent or another? It seemed to me to have great potential, both as a great tale and something that would speak to modern readers.